This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I have been, for the last 2 hours, if you're just tuning in, talking about how I think there is a meaningful and qualitative difference between billionaires who have been given the legal ability by a corrupt Supreme Court. And I think that Thomas and Scalia, for example, going and speaking to the Koch brothers events, Scalia hanging out with Dick Cheney, going duck hunting with him, and then deciding on his favor in the Supreme Court a few weeks later. I think there's a meaningful difference between corrupt billionaires corrupting our democracy and electing people who will dance to their tune, and foreign governments corrupting our democracy, whether it's through poisoning channels of information, like the massive number of advertisements on Facebook, or whether it's through hacking into electronic voting machines, which appears to have happened, or whether it's, I guess there's a variety of techniques that have been and strategies that have been employed here. I think that there is a significant and qualitative difference there. And that when Donald Trump is putting his legitimacy as President of the United States and I actually believe he believes this, and his belief that he wouldn't be president if it wasn't for the help of foreign governments, specifically Russia. When he puts that ahead of the interests of the country of which he is president, you can be impeached for high crimes, for misdemeanors, which is what they went after Bill Clinton for, or for treason. And I think that moves into the realm of treason. Either collaborating with a foreign power, as apparently was done by Manafort and Fred's. Excuse me, I had to sneeze there. When the Republican Party changed their position, relative to Russia and Ukraine and all that. And I'm very ambivalent about the whole Ukraine-Crimea thing. I mean, it's not as simple or as cut and dry as we tend to think. And there's a history there that goes even way back before World War II. And there's a history there of the United States meddling in elections in Ukraine, as in Syria, Russia has a military base in Crimea, and they have a military base in Syria. We protect our military bases around the world, and many of them are in countries run by dictators, and we're fine with that. I get all that, but this is a whole different thing. Those are areas where we can have foreign policy debates. What's more important? Is it more important to quote stand up for Crimea? That's a foreign policy debate we can have internally. But when you're talking about a foreign country messing with your elections, and the person who is the beneficiary of that not saying, "Wait a minute, we got a problem," then you're in the area of treason, in my opinion. And the reason, if for no other reason, and somebody needs to point this out to Donald Trump, and in fact, this may be the conversation that his national security advisor is having with him right now, is, Donald, if you think that Vladimir Putin helped make you president, and you don't want to mess with, you don't want the so-called witch hunt investigation into Russian involvement in the American elections, you don't want that to continue. Do you realize that if you piss off Putin, he might be the guy who takes you out in 2.5 years, metaphorically speaking, electorally speaking? Don't you get it? If you're allowing a foreign power to mess with our elections, anything can happen. It's not just always going to inure to your benefit to you. And Trump doesn't get that. And the whole thing with Trump and autocrats, I've been talking about this throughout the show today. I think it's worth recapping very, very quickly, and then I'm going to get back to your phone calls, because a lot of you have been on hold for a long time, and a lot of people are very passionate about this stuff. Number one, Now is not the time to despair. Now is not the time to say, oh my God, it's just terrible. Look at what's happened. I mean, you know, you've got Kris Kobach pushing people off the voting rolls, and you've got voting machines that don't count votes, and you've got, and then you've got, you know, foreign governments, propagating fake news, and you've got a billionaire, Rupert Murdoch, you know, with a television network that regularly deletes, distorts, and generalizes information to the point that good and decent and intelligent people, and I met a few of them in Orlando over the weekend, who are mostly informed by Fox News, are tragically malinformed. Not just misinformed, malinformed about actual, real, you know, politics and economic and international, but particularly domestic policy issues, because it works to the benefit of the billionaire class. To have to have the people of the United States believe that what's best for the billionaires is best for them, and thus vote Republican. I mean, we've got all this stuff happening at the same time, and the reason I think that Trump is much more friendly with autocrats, the reason I think Trump, if you looked at his body language this morning, when he was sitting there with President Putin, Trump was praying. I mean that literally. Take a look at the picture. He was holding his hands in front of him, between his legs, between his knees, in a gesture of prayer. This is how we pray. He was the supplicant. And Putin was leaning back in his chair, his body tilted, his legs spread apart, like, I'm the boss here. And Trump was praying. Now, I don't think he was praying that the PP tapes don't come out. I don't think he cares. I mean, you know, the tape came out of him saying that he grabs women by the crotch and he can get away with it. And he does it regularly. He still got elected. I don't think he cares if the PP tape comes out. I think what he cares about is if Putin was to say to a few of his buddy Russian oligarchs, hey, you know that $300 million you loaned Trump? You know that $1 billion you loaned Trump? You know that $3 billion that you used to buy Trump properties? Get your money back. And Trump's entire business empire goes down. That's what I think is going on. That's what I think Trump is afraid of. And frankly, I don't think Russia has to even threaten it. Trump knows. Putin doesn't have to say a word. Trump's own son, Eric, back in, I think it was in 2013, told a reporter for one of the financial papers when they asked, you know, okay, you know, your father just had his fifth or sixth bankruptcy. Are you having, you know, problems with your real estate business? He was, no. He said, we're no longer going to American banks. We're getting our money from Russia. And he didn't mean the Russian government or Putin. He meant the Russian oligarchs. But the Russian oligarchs, I mean, this is another thing about Russia and their economy that I think it's really important to point out. Russia has an economy that's roughly the size of Texas's economy, right? The GDP of Russia and the GDP of Texas are very similar. It's not one of the largest countries in the world economically. It is physically. I think it's the second largest after China. It's got a huge population. It's got massive natural resources. And it has tremendous potential as a nation, but economically not so much. Why is that? I personally believe, and, you know, Louise and I were in Moscow before the fall of the Soviet Union. We just went through for a couple days as tourists. It was fascinating. We were there after the fall of the Soviet Union. I was in Hungary with my friend Jerry Schneiderman, my best friend. We were sitting in a cafe in Budapest. As the refugees were starting to come in from East Germany, when the wall was coming down, I've been there. I've seen it. I worked with the Salem International Organization, saleminternational.org, in Kaliningrad, which is part of Russia. In fact, it used to be the high security area because it's near a submarine base. In fact, I wrote a chapter about this in one of my books. Working with a local community that was teaching agricultural practices as these people were coming out of the shock of the fall of the Soviet Union. I was in Russia the day of the election that was the first election in the history of Russia when Boris Yeltsin was elected. I was there watching TV with the Russian family. We were working on in this charity group. And what happened was the Chicago boys did, in my opinion, did the same thing to Russia that they did to Chile, that they're trying to do now to the United States. They went into Russia and they said, okay, you know, your economy is no longer communist. Here's what you do. You take all the publicly owned property and you privatize it. And you give it to the people and you let the people sell it however they want. And the people were very, very poor. And so they were selling off their apartments and they were selling off their cars and they were selling off their goods and they were selling off their shares in the big national companies like the oil companies and the steel companies and the gas companies. And the people who were connected with the government and who had access to big money and banking, they were buying these chits up, C-H-I-T-S. They were like coupons that everybody was given. They were buying these things up and they ended up, and this was absolutely predictable from my point of view, because Russia, quote, liberalized along the lines of libertarian / republican economics, Russia went from the potential of being a high-functioning economy and a high-functioning democracy to being more of an autocratic oligarchy where, you know, the very, very rich are the ones who have the political power. Much like the United States is becoming right now, thanks to our Supreme Court, bought and paid for by, you know, the billionaires among us. So, you know, you can blame Milton Friedman for a lot of this, frankly. But this is where we're at. And in my opinion, the only solution is to take the House of Representatives, and it may not happen in this election, it may happen in 2020, but to take the House of Representatives and take two-thirds of the Senate and initiate impeachment proceedings against both Trump and Pence, who is absolutely 100% complicit in the whole thing and was in charge of the transition team. And when they're out, the Speaker of the House becomes president, who would be a Democrat, and you would have effectively reversed the 2016 elections. I'll pick up your phone calls on the other side of this break. It's 18 and a half minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's talk media for the sane among us, the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be back with your calls after this. And welcome back. Doug in Reno Valley, California. Am I saying that right, Doug?
Hi, my compliments.
Thank you.
My
back at you.
I want your opinion on what, if Democrats get Congress back, what's the first thing they should do?
If by Congress, do you mean the House of Representatives or both the House and the Senate?
Well, I don't think we're going to get the Senate, but.
Yeah. Anything's possible, but the Koch brothers are pouring, millions and millions of dollars into this election, so it's going to be a big challenge. But if they get the House of Representatives, I think the first thing that they should do is basically a variation on what the Republicans did when they took control of Congress in the Newt Gingrich Revolution in, I forget which year it was, whether it was 94 or 96, but, you know, while Bill Clinton was president, and initiate massive congressional investigations into every aspect of what the Trump administration has been doing. They should initiate investigations into, obviously, you know, the Trump-Russia stuff. They should initiate public investigations into the destruction of the Environmental Protection Agency. They should initiate investigations into who benefited from Ryan Zinke selling off public lands. They should initiate investigations into Mick Mulvaney is taking apart the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. They should initiate investigations into Betsy DeVos and her ownership of some of these companies that are holding these immigrant children for $700 a night, and her support for ending public education functionally as we know it. They should initiate investigations into Wilbur Ross's involvement with, you know, Russian banks and other banks, the Bank of Cyprus and all this stuff. I mean, there is so much dirt in this administration that needs to be, you know, the rug needs to be lifted and it needs to be swept out. And this can only be done with the power of a subpoena, and only the party in power has the power of subpoena in either the House or the Senate. So what they should do is they should use that subpoena power as aggressively as they can and constantly, without stop, every single day, they should be looking into these things, and they should be doing it in a very public way. Does that make sense, Doug?
Yeah, I didn't expect that much detail. I thought you were going to say, well, Citizens United term limits on the Supreme Court.
You're not going to get any of that stuff until you got two-thirds of the Senate. And you're not going to get impeachment until you've got two-thirds of the Senate, unless the bills that are put forward. Now, the wild card here, Doug, and it's a really important one to remember, the wild card is if Mueller comes out with indictments that actually get into the Trump organization itself and that get into the Republican Party beyond the hangers-on, the Papadopouloses and the Gates and the Manaforts, who are basically exploiting their position and corrupting the Republican Party, but not necessarily with the enthusiastic consent of the Republican Party. But if they can demonstrate that there was actual high crimes and misdemeanors and treason committed by Donald Trump himself, by members of his family, and I'm thinking, the meeting in Trump Tower to try, with the Russians to try and get information on Hillary Clinton, stuff like that, I'm guessing that there's a whole lot more than just that. And when this stuff starts to come down and get visible, I mean, this is what Strzok was talking about. Peter Strzok, the FBI agent, who was our number one spy catcher, right? And this is what he was talking about. He was like, there was serious stuff here. We need to be worried. And we still don't know what that stuff is. So when that stuff comes out, that may change the equation even more. But I think that using the power of the subpoena is going to be the most powerful thing they can do. And that, by the way, is what the Republicans did in the 90s, and it worked for them. Doug, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with me, with you. You've heard my rant. I'm with me too, I guess. Somebody called a minute ago, and I think this is a really important point. I want to emphasize it again. And that is that if the Democrats take the House of Representatives, people are like, what should we do? What should our first priority be? And they may take the Senate too. But in particular, it looks like, there's a very good chance the Democrats are going to take the House of Representatives, notwithstanding, voter suppression and the millions, hundreds of millions of dollars of the Koch brothers. But if they take the House of Representatives, the weapon that they will have handed to them is the subpoena, the ability to compel witnesses to come before Congress and publicly testify. The Republicans used this against Peter Strzok from the FBI last week, which was bizarre in the extreme. It was like an old Soviet show trial. But the Republicans have used this successfully. The Democrats need to, if they take control of the House. That's the thing that they have to do. Jenny in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Jenny, what's on your mind?
I'm very concerned about all the things that you've covered. We are all worried about. I'd like to comment that I don't think Trump's beyond crashing this country and putting in chaos to keep himself and his family out of jail. And the second thing, he, at the time of the election, when he came in the White House, he said, I don't care how the numbers look. It's rigged. I'll just walk in there. So who's to take and actually figure that man may not remove himself, even if the votes show he has a legitimate reason to get the hell out of there? He may not go.
Jenny, I have a lot of faith in our institutions, what Donald Trump refers to as the deep state.
They're all weakened now. He attacks all of them, and the majority,
except for the military,
believing this.
Except for the military. The problem that we have with the military is much of the military watches Fox News, and so they're badly informed. They don't know actually what's going on in the world. But, setting that aside for the moment, I have confidence in our institutions. I think if Trump were to say, if he were to lose the election of 2020, if he's running for re-election and refused to leave the White House, I think the military would escort him out. That would be the breaking point. And there's no doubt in my mind.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, there's no doubt in my mind about that. And I'll tell you, when I lived in Washington, D.C., as we lived on a boat at the Capitol Yacht Club in a community of people. The majority of them were military, mostly Navy, but a lot of military people. And I got to know a lot of these folks, and many of them were Trump supporters. But they would not put up with that. No way. No way. And I'm talking about, like, literally admirals. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
More of your calls, my thoughts, and the news of the obvious news of the day right after the sticker. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Zach in North Hollywood, California. Hey, Zach, what's on your mind today?
Oh, Tom, good to speak with you. You know, your substitute, Jefferson Smith, has got such great insights and perspectives tinged with a little bit of humor. What a great guy he is.
I'm so glad to hear that. Jefferson is one of my favorite people. He's been around politics. He served in the House of Representatives here in the state of Oregon. Years ago, he started the Bus Project, which is one of the big, you know, one of the good big progressive organizations. Started a progressive radio station here in town. He's been around the block, and he's a good guy, and he's a lawyer. In fact, I think he's a Harvard graduate.
And I want to visit a point that he makes over and over that it's really not a right and left. It really never was, but. To me, it's the 10% daddy downers versus us 90% bottom uppers.
Yep.
But the daddy downers have the capital to trick you into liking them.
Yep. That's exactly what's going on.
Trump's base has to realize, man, these free market guys, it's not even politics anymore. Our future is being projected by white-collar criminals. The free market means the freedom to destroy and exploit anything you want to leverage profit, including democracy.
Yep. Very, very well said, Zach. Very well said.
I'll see you. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the call. Excellent comment. Sam in Canton, North Carolina. Hey, Sam, what's on your mind?
I would like for you and everyone else in the media to stop speaking about Donald Trump as though he is an intelligent man. He's not. There is a word that we used to use more. It's now politically incorrect. The word is stupid.
Yeah.
And a famous movie character once said, stupid is as stupid does. If you look at what Donald Trump does, if you can bring yourself to listen to one of his speeches, and I usually want to break something when I hear one of them, he does not speak in coherent sentences. He doesn't even speak in complete sentences. He stands there and psychobabbles. And one thing that I've noticed, because I'll look up the venues he's been speaking in the past several weeks, he has not spoken to a crowd of more than 7,000 in months. And there were 10,000.
You know why that is?
Say what?
Do you know why that is? I can tell you. I can tell you why that is.
Because he can't get a larger crowd than that without having a bunch of people protesting him.
Well, it's a variation on that. The only people that they let in are people who have donated to the Trump campaign so that they know that they are loyal Republicans, people who have a history of donating to the Trump campaign. That's the only way to get an invitation to these, because these are actually campaign rallies. These are not President of the United States speaking to the people, town hall things.
But if I
may, Sam, before we move on, you said you don't think Donald Trump is smart. I think it all depends on how you define smart. I don't think he's smart academically. I don't think he's smart intellectually. I doubt his IQ is over 110, but he is sly. This guy has what used to be called street smarts, and he's using them not for the good force. He's using them for the evil force. But this guy has a long history of manipulating people, threatening, of bullying, of bluffing. I mean, he's got. And street smarts is even, generally considered to be a positive, and I mean it in its most negative sense. But I think in that context, we cannot ignore the fact that he knows what he's doing, and he knows how to do it very, very well. He's been doing it his whole life, and he's doing it now to his country. Back to you,
Sam. This is from Tony Schwartz, the man who co-wrote Art of the Deal.
Right.
And I quote, "We are in a true emergency. He now lives inside his own version of reality almost 100% of the time, and that reality has almost nothing to do with the reality the rest of us know it."
I agree. Yeah. And it's an echo chamber, by the way, and I think this is really important to note, that largely exists on Fox News, which is acting like state television did during the Soviet Union. And that is a tragedy for American democracy. It's just a plain old, flat-out, screaming tragedy. Sam, thanks a lot for the call. Wolfgang in Greenwich, Connecticut. Hey, Wolfgang, what's up?
Thank you, Tom, for taking my call. Big fan.
Thank you.
Tom, what do you think about the Dr. Chomskys and the Chris Hedges and the Ralph Naders of the world that say there's 3,000 American corporations or subsidiaries or holding companies in Russia, including companies from the military-industrial complex like Boeing, and out of the 5,000 largest corporations in Russia, 3,000 are American, then there's Germans and these. Does that have an influence on their elections that so much foreign American capital is over there? And the fact that these corporations are over there, these holding companies, it seems that whatever Trump may have done or the Russians may have done is a tiny amount compared to whether Starbucks just opened its 100th store or J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs are the three largest banks in Russia. It just seems that people like Chomsky who say nation states don't exist anymore and it's really about corporations and that the media wants to say one thing or another. How do you answer that?
I think that it's a matter of scale. I think first of all, I don't know I know that Chomsky quote, but I don't know his thoughts on Russia. Or Hedges or the others. But the thing to keep in mind is that Russia's economy is about the same size as the state of Texas. And that's the entire GDP, the entire economy. And a very, very large slice of that is the state oil and gas companies. And, you know, some privatized, some semi-privatized, some still owned by the Russian government. And so what's left over, what the rest of their economy is far smaller than the state of Texas. So I don't see how that kind of, you know, I could get the economic power of China altering American corporate behavior. We saw Facebook going along with censorship. We saw Google going along with censorship in China. We saw American companies manufacturing equipment to sell to the Chinese government to allow them not just to spy on their own people, but to track their own people down and execute them when they say things the government doesn't like. We have been seeing this for some time. We see American companies violating the core principles that this country, you know, espouses for a buck. Because in China, it's hundreds of billions of bucks. But Russia's economy is not that big. Like I said, it's smaller than the state of Texas. It's an important country. It's geographically and strategically a very important country. It is, I believe, the second largest country in the world physically. It's got a large population. It's got huge natural resources. There's a lot that could be done with Russia. I think that it has devolved into oligarchy as the same direction that we're moving as a result of the guys who went over there when Boris Yeltsin was first elected from the Chicago School of Economics, the Milton Friedman guys, who said, hey, you know, we're going to prove that libertarian economics works. And that's how that's what they executed when they changed the Soviet Union into Russia. And guess what? Libertarian economics always ends in oligarchy and plutocracy, and there you are. But I doubt that it's got that the economy is so large there that it would cause Boeing, for example, to say to a senator, hey, we really want to protect our Russian business, and you know if you do something that might embarrass Russia, we're not going to support you anymore. If that's what you're implying, am I correctly understanding, Wolfgang, your concern?
Well, no. Well, if the 5,000 largest corporations in the United States, if 3,000 of them were Russian and they were controlling the banking, the largest and the resources, and they were subsidiaries,
yeah. Where'd you get that number from, Wolfgang? I've never heard that anything like that. Where'd you get that from?
Well, you can Google it. It's. I mean, if you.
Well, it doesn't make it true. What's the source?
You have to let me give you my sources.
Go for it,
Tom. Before you.
Please.
If you Google it in Washington, I mean, there's many different ways of finding out how many American corporations. What are the largest ones in Russia?
Right.
And that would seem, if they're controlling their economy, that's a huge more influence on us controlling their natural resources and their economy and everything else versus some guy, you know, sending some hacks in the computer. And to compare the two to people like Chomsky and Chris Hedges, and as I said, it's more about not nation states, but about, corporate control of the globe. And I was just wondering your opinion, because I know you're very sharp.
I think corporate control of the globe is destroying democracy. I think that, you know, if you'll recall, when the book was written, The End of History and the Last Man, which came out in the early 2000s or maybe the late 90s, I think it was the early 2000s. It was after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and I'm drawing a blank on the author's name, but he was one of the more famous semi-neoconservative authors. But basically, the theory was that, you know, with the fall of the Soviet Union, capitalism has now triumphed, and that's going to lead to the spreading of democracy all over the world. This was the neoconservative sales pitch, and this was embedded in the philosophy that was behind the whole group that, you know, that Jeb Bush was part of back in '98, that was arguing for the invasion of Iraq and et cetera. And I think that, you know, history has demonstrated that that's not the case. And in fact, what we've seen is in the last decade or so, the last 15, 20 years, we've seen a number of countries that previously used to be quite democratic, like the Philippines, like Turkey, like Hungary, become autocratic states. And you know, the hope for Russia was that it would become a democratic state, but because they organized their economy and let these big corporations in and created these autocrats along the lines of libertarian economics, we have this mess that we, or they have that mess that they have. And we have the a similar mess. It's a different scale, but we have a similar mess here in the United States with a small handful of billionaires basically controlling our politics as well. So I get what you're saying, Wolfgang. I get what you're saying. Thanks a lot for the call. I would love to see a source of information about, you know, what the actual slicing dicing of the Russian economy is, because I just don't know. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
In fact, Wolfgang, if you think you can find a good source on that, or if anybody else does, just tweet it to me. I read my Twitter feed. I'll check it out. We'll be back. And welcome back. Jordan in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Jordan, what's on your mind today?
Thanks for taking my call, Tom. I just wanted to say I kind of disagreed with your point. I don't subscribe to the theory that it's purely a business motivation, and the evidence that I have to support that.
Wait, hang on just a second. There's something missing here. Are you talking about Donald Trump's apparent love for Vladimir Putin?
Correct.
Okay.
So, and the evidence I have to support that would be these three pieces. I think the tariffs, which are the retaliation that's coming from China, is designed to hurt his voting base.
Right.
He does not care about that piece. The second piece is on July 4th when he posted the picture of his children of 46 and 47. I think that also was a warning shot, saying I don't care about your political norms. And third,
wait a second. He posted a. I don't know about this picture on July 4th. Tell me about it.
There's a picture of his children.
You mean
I don't know if
you mean Don Jr., Eric, and Ivanka?
Correct.
Okay.
And on the only caption on it is 46 and 47.
In other words, the next two presidents.
Correct.
Okay.
And then the last piece is this last weekend, how he continually referred to his administration as a regime. These three things to me are saying this has nothing to do with business. He wants this country for himself, and Putin has challenged him and said, "Are you strong enough to take it?" And he looks up to strong people, and so he's trying to do everything that he can to be part of that challenge.
You know, Jordan, I don't think we're that far apart. I have been saying this for some time, that Putin admires autocrats because autocrats run countries like CEOs run businesses, which is the only thing Trump knows. His father owned the business. His father gave him the business, essentially. He's been an autocrat his entire life. He looks at our country and says, what's this democracy thing? I can get things done faster and better by myself with my merry band of billionaires. We should be running everything. And that's what he's trying to do. It's what he's been trying to do for a year and a half, and what he's actually been successfully doing, selling off public lands, destroying the environment. And he's doing it because he, and I think that, you know, many of these guys, you know, Erdogan, Orban in Hungary, you know, Duterte in the Philippines, Xi in China, you know, I think these guys actually believe, and there may be some truth to it, by the way, that it's easier to run a country if you run it like a company than it is to have that messy thing called democracy, where everybody gets to debate and everybody gets to vote, and sometimes the people don't get it right, and sometimes it gets screwed up, and the people who should be in power are no longer in power, and all that kind of thing. And so I would say, Jordan, that I essentially agree with you.
I would say I agree as well. I don't like it being masked that these are business decisions, and that because it has to do with judges or other type of things that the Republican oligarchs are advocating for.
Oh, I get your point. No, I've been saying all along, there are multiple layers to this and that are completely missed by the media because they try to simplify everything down to a bumper sticker and missed by many of our politicians. You know, Trump is admiring Putin as an autocrat, number one. Number two, he wants to have a hotel in Moscow. He was negotiating, you know, Michael Cohen was negotiating it right up to a few months before the election. You know, so there is a business piece to it. Number three, he has this worldview that running a country like a company is the best way to run a country, which is a variation on the conservative philosophy that was laid out in the 50s by Russell Kirk and has been followed by the Republican Party ever since. So I agree with you. I think it's multidimensional, and it diminishes our political discussions to not acknowledge that and to all make it all about, you know, the boogeyman of Vladimir Putin. That's where I push back. Jordan, thanks a lot for the call. Very, very well said. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Paul in North San Juan, California. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. What's on my mind is the amount of attention that MSNBC and the other big channels, television companies, and your program, too, devote to Donald Trump and his activities.
Paul, thank you for your opinion. If you were in Germany in 1933, and I'm not even going to go there. Brent, I do. By the way, Paul, agree with you on the media that represents itself as news, and that would be the so-called news networks. If you're representing yourself as news, you should cover the news, and people should be well informed. I am not representing myself as news. This is an opinion show. This is talk radio. And so if I want to talk about, you know, how I think Donald Trump is selling us down the tubes for 3 hours, that's fine with me. And you can choose to listen or not. But I do agree that I think with the larger point that you're trying to make, which is, and this is how Trump won the primary, by the way. And frankly, I think probably largely how he won the general election, is he got literally billions of dollars worth of free television time and people thought they were watching the news, and in fact what they were watching was the Trump reality show / propaganda machine. Brent in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Brent, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, thank you. So you keep referencing the book from the 50s. I forgot the author's name.
Russell Kirk, The Conservative Mind.
And how, you know, giving middle-class people a vote is going to mess everything up. That wasn't a new thought in the 50s. I mean, even Plato was discussing that in Socrates.
Oh, Alexander Hamilton was an advocate of this, of you know, only property owners being allowed to vote and the president being a lifetime appointment.
But if we look at Socrates' example, he kind of believed you run it like a company, but the key was to have philosophers, people who actually have good thoughts. Donald Trump fails the idea of a philosopher, as does George W. Bush.
Well, and you know, this is how
down the line.
This was how Jefferson sold the Electoral College. And it wasn't just Jefferson, by the way. Ben Franklin was in on this, and there were a few others. They looked at the Iroquois Confederacy, and Ben Franklin, they had some 30 representatives of the Iroquois Confederacy that they invited to the opening ceremonies of the Constitutional Convention in I believe it was August or maybe July of 1787. And Ben Franklin got up and gave this speech where he said, you know, if five nations of ignorant savages, and this is pretty much word for word, you can Google it, if five nations of ignorant savages have been able to forge a union which has existed in peace for 1,000 years, then certainly 13 colonies of educated Englishmen can do the same. And he didn't mean ignorant savages as a slur. They admired the Iroquois Confederacy, and so the idea of the Electoral College, it was helping preserve the strength that the Senate also helped preserve of the small states, and the states that had small white populations, which included states like Georgia, in other words, the slave states. But also the theory that Jefferson and Franklin used to sell the Electoral College was these people are independent of political influence. They actually don't have to vote the way that the people who sent them to the Electoral College asked them to vote. And it's happened a half a dozen times in our history where electors have said, you know, the people in the district that I'm representing voted for, you know, Lyndon Johnson for president, but I'm going to vote for Richard Nixon or whatever. No, it wasn't Nixon, whoever it was. You get my point. And the idea that they would be the best and brightest, that people would select, because communities are political parties now, but originally, you know, when the country was put together, there were not political parties, and it was supposed to be communities, would select their smartest, wisest elders to be members of the Electoral College. And it was based on something that was referred to by the based on something that was from the old pre-Anglo-Saxon, from the Whig histories, before the invasion of Europe by the Romans. And Jefferson writes about this at length, and you'll find this in Tacitus. Tacitus wrote about this in a book that Jefferson recommended and I read back in the day, that they had this thing called the Wikigemeinschaft, or a word like that. I'm probably making it sound more German than it sounded, but you know, the language that they spoke was a variation on German, and they were largely, you know, red-haired people, which Jefferson thought was really cool, and it was like the Council of Wise Elders, and just like the Iroquois, once a year each community would elect one person to be one man to be the wise elder who would go to the whole big meeting, and would they come back and say, okay, here's what we're all thinking about. The women in the community would vote, then the man would have to go back and say, here's what we're going to do. And Jefferson and Franklin wanted to do the same thing. They just wanted to cut the women out of the equation. And so it was based on that Iroquois Confederacy thing in some ways. And it's just a fascinating history. But they were pulling it from Plato, too, and the Native Americans. So I don't know what to do with that, Brent. but it's an interesting history.
I really do wish that you know, we could have intelligent folks in charge.
I agree.
And get rid of some of the democracy.
I agree. And I think if we could get money out of politics and get the billionaires out so that they can no longer basically hire, you know, their toadies to do their bidding in Congress, that we'd be we'd have a whole lot better quality of politicians. Brent, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to us on SiriusXM. We'll be back tomorrow. No shortage of news this week, I guarantee you. In the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. If we have any hope at all in turning this republic back to a republic, it's going to involve you getting out there and getting active. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.